This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, from the studios of the Library of Congress. And we have a great day today because we have the new translator of a brand new edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Aeneid. Richard Colarisi, welcome to the library.
Thank you.
And we want to know all about this. First of all, it is a real turning point in classic literature, and you did it. When did you decide, and why did you decide, to tackle this lifelong journey of translating Virgil?
Actually, it was sometime during college. I had taken Latin through high school, 4 years, and then all of my college years I studied advanced Latin. And I loved Virgil almost from the start. And I looked up the translations of him and found them just, it wasn't the same as what I was translating. They were nowhere even close to the Virgil I loved.
Well, what made you, as a child, a 10-year-old, fascinated with Latin?
I don't know. All I know is from earliest childhood, even at the library, I would pick out books by the Greeks and the Romans and want to read them. At ninth grade, first year Latin was the first thing I excelled at in school.
Turning point of your life. Little did you know in the ninth grade that you would be the foremost translator of Virgil in this year. Well, give us a little bit about Richard Colarisi. What was your background?
Oh, I grew up in Connecticut, and as soon as I finished high school, that month I joined the Brothers of Holy Cross. And became a Brother of Holy Cross.
Did having Latin help you, or did it burnish your Latin by being a brother?
It didn't. It was neutral. There were not many. There were some. They were teaching brothers, and there were other Latin teachers. But I looked like I was maybe going to end up one of them.
And so, how long were you a brother, and then what happened?
I was a brother for 9 years and left the community here in Maryland. I was teaching at Bishop McNamara High School, taught then for 3 years at Gonzaga College High School on North Capitol Street.
An interloper.
Yes.
A Holy Cross brother at a Jesuit school. And when did you become a lawyer?
It was only after I quit teaching after 3 years and then I got a job. Someone gave me a job that was very lucrative, actually. But I was bored silly with it, and so I went to law school. And as the day I passed the bar exam, I quit that job and found I had a job with a lawyer.
And you were a civil rights attorney.
I became that, yes. Initially, I took anything that came in the door. But very quickly, my practice then began to focus on constitutional law, civil rights, and governmental, advising governments, writing their legislations, and et cetera.
So there we are, a Latin scholar who is practicing law, and now he is a translator of what I hope will be the standard text for the Aeneid. Now let's get to it. Who is Virgil?
Virgil. A poet during the time when Julius Caesar was, he lived in that time while Caesar, he had been born and was a young man in northern Italy and near the Alps when Caesar was conquering Gaul.
Now, did
Julius Caesar.
Did Julius Caesar commission this?
No, or? Not Julius Caesar. Oh. Julius Caesar, didn't last that long. Virgil was still growing up, and he went to school first in Milan, in the Milan area, and he was such a promising student, he quickly was transferred just outside of Rome to a famous school. One of the students there was Octavian, Caesar, who was the, and they, we believe they met then. And Octavian had a right-hand man who took care of publicity.
PR man.
And he must have focused in on Virgil. And Virgil began writing and soon had was gifted a house in Naples. And then he had another one in Rome. And so clearly, and it was Octavian, after Julius Caesar had died, who asked him to write the Roman epic, the story of the foundation of Rome.
How Rome was founded. Wow. And then can you summarize for us briefly the Aeneid, and then we'll parse it?
The Aeneid tells the story of Aeneas, who was in Homer. He's a character in Homer. He was a Trojan who Virgil created the fiction that he survived and formed a band of survivors of Troy and was commissioned by Jupiter to found a new city in Italy.
Okay, so I'm just a beginner, and the Trojan War happened with the Greeks, and Aeneas was a Trojan. He was left over after the war. He was given a great mission, right?
That's correct.
And then the story is full of action, adventure, and love. And tell us a little bit of what happens in Aeneas' journey.
Well, Aeneas is dogged along his journey to the to Italy by Juno, who was very angry that he's alive at all and that there are any survivors of Troy. Paris, we all know, the Prince of Troy, had made the mistake of being a judge of a beauty contest of the goddesses and had awarded the most beautiful to Venus rather than Juno, and she never forgave the Trojans.
Those gods and goddesses, they really were a mess, weren't they? They ruled everything, but you never know which way they were going to go. You could pray your heart out and get the wrong. And so Aeneas was bound by duty to the gods and goddesses. And how did Juno factor into that?
She tried to stop him. And actually, at the first scene of the poem, she raises a huge storm to sink his fleet as they have just left Sicily and are heading north toward where Rome would be. And only Neptune saves him and chases away the storm.
I like very much the map you have in the book. That helped me a lot. And this is truly a readable page-turner. And I think that's what you wanted. Tell us about how you felt when you read the other translations.
I couldn't stay with them. They were very dense. They were kind of poetic. And Virgil was such a presence in the Aeneid when you read it in Latin, and he was absent. They were telling a story, but it was without this magnificent, shy, wide-eyed presence of this magnificent poet who you just couldn't help but notice just by things he said. Some of the phrases are almost untranslatable.
Virgil.
Yes, that Virgil did. He was truly, whatever he took on literarily, he occupied the field.
And so you're just you. And, you know, this former brother of the Holy Cross, you're a civil rights attorney, and you know that you can make this accessible to everybody. And you took 10 years to do that.
Yes.
Well, that is awe-inspiring. How difficult was it?
It was difficult. Virgil is the most difficult Latin. And it's always a struggle. I found some wonderful books that helped you along with some of the, because it is difficult, but it's also utterly magnificent.
How did you keep going?
When I finished, I was retiring from my law practice, I was saying, what can I do? And suddenly it was there. It was like
Virgil
someone
came
I had a crush
you.
On and said, translate the Aeneid. So I simply began and couldn't stop.
And couldn't stop. Well, we know Aeneid went on a great journey. Do you think that Virgil was greatly influenced by the Odyssey?
By both. Homer, I mean, he used all of the techniques of Homer. He was very familiar with Homer, but added so much of his own that was, and he's much more complicated than Homer is. Aeneas is not just a heroic person. He is a sufferer. When he was born, his mother was Venus, the goddess, and a prince of Troy, Anchises, and she was so disappointed that he wasn't immortal and was born a mortal. She named him Aeneas, and it's a root word having to do with disgruntlement, of sorrow.
What a terrible thing to be named sorrow.
And Virgil plays on that all the way through the Aeneid. With the opening scene, you meet Aeneas, the storm is raging, and he's wishing he were dead. It would have been a blessing to die at Troy, he says. Rather than endure this.
And so right away, the reader is so empathetic and on his side. We're always on the side of the underdog, right?
Yes.
And what does he encounter in his journeys?
There are so many things. Some of them, the Cyclops, just as there was, and he is mimicking, but with very different twists. Homer and the... And he is, first of all, they are confused. They are getting other signs and saying, oh, this must be the place. So this must be the place. They're not always sure that they are heading to Italy until finally they come to a Greek city where a survivor of Troy is now the prince. But he was the administrative assistant to one of the Greek warriors. Who died, and then he became the administrator, and he does this huge, long prophecy. He reads the omens and takes him into the temple and gives him exact locations where he's to go, what he's to be afraid of, to get from Greece, the Western Greece, to go, and he must go around Sicily to the other side of Italy. And must avoid the pathway between Sicily and Italy because of Scylla and Charybdis. They are a whirlpool and a storm, if you wish. They will eat them alive if they go through the strait between Italy. They must go around.
But he found other problems and other battles to solve. It was one damn thing after another, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He was an unfortunate man.
But this is what I really loved about your book. First of all, the language just sparkles. What about the word choices? Did you have decisions to make about sometimes which word the Latin might translate to? And you made a richer choice?
Well, I wouldn't call it a richer. I was trying for a Virgil choice. Latin doesn't have the huge vocabulary and colorations of its words that English has.
Or Greek, maybe.
Yes, and probably Greek. But English is particularly, since it's a merger of French as well as Germanic, has many, many words for the same thing with just a slight emphasis on color. And so what I would do is he would take a word that was like angry, and I would say, all right, but I'm not going to use the word angry. I'm just not going to repeat that. And I tried to figure out what he really meant, and it was close. They were synonyms of angry, but with coloration. And so I spent a lot of time with that.
What word did you use instead of angry?
Well, there are a number of them. Distraught. There are thousands of words. Fiery.
Yeah.
But there were others.
Well, it's very imagistic. Your writing is extremely imagistic.
Oh, thank
and I
you.
Think every, not only poets, will read it because it's action-adventure. There's love, there's everything. Why don't you read us a little bit, a page from it, and set it up so we'll know what's happening.
Okay.
I mean, some of the people listening have never read it, like I would say 100% of them. And these are the people who are going to read it. This is Richard Colarisi, the translator of the New Aeneid.
And so the first passage I take is from book one, and that storm, the shipwreck, some half of his fleet is gone, and he finds shelter at a harbor in North Africa. But they are distraught that they have lost half of their fleet. And so they finally cook a meal, they sit down, and then Aeneas addresses them, these survivors, and has some wonderful lines in there. And he said, Aeneas speaks to his grieving comrades. My friends and comrades, none of us are strangers to misfortune. Just as the gods delivered us from even greater peril, so will they find us a way out of this. You have faced down the multi-headed Scylla, the echoing rocks of Charybdis, and the hurling boulders of the Cyclops. Take heart yet again. Defy the voice of despair within you. Perchance, one day it will give you pleasure to remember even these days. We have held true to our course in spite of danger or loss, and we must continue to keep our bearings as we sail toward Latium, where the fates have ordained for us a home and a blessed life. So it is foretold, and so it shall be. Troy will rise again. Endure and press forward for the blessed times to come.
I believe all the great statesmen in the past have read these words. I bet Lincoln did, I'm sure, because they are so noble and so inspiring. I think that's a beautiful passage. He himself needed to talk himself into it, right? How did you decide to format the book so that you had some words in italics and some words not?
Actually, anytime someone is speaking, there's so many speeches, and some of them are long in the Aeneid. I chose to put all those direct quotes in italics. Because I know what I do when I get a long, long, long speech and not sure I want to endure it. I look to see how long is it. And the reader could easily tell where.
Some are many pages.
Yeah, and usually that talked me into finishing them too. So that was my choice, that all the direct speaking parts were in italics.
But that isn't done in another book, is it?
No. That was my choice.
That is a helpful thing. And I think that aesthetically, you made some very good choices just how the text should look, which is really an important and innovative approach, I believe.
Thank you.
Yeah. I feel that here we have the conflicts of Aeneas. But what interests me the most is how fate is a character in this book. How is it that Aeneas had his own wishes and motivations, but he always had to do the fatalistic thing? What was it, his pledge? What is his directive? How is it that he was guided by fate and devoted to faith?
Yes, and Aeneas says that if he had made the choice, he would have stayed at Troy and rebuilt it. But the fates had ruled otherwise. And the words that Virgil always uses for Aeneas are pius Aeneas. Pius meaning not pious, but dutiful. He was always sworn to do what the gods wanted him to do, even sometimes reluctantly.
Out of fear, though.
It wasn't just out of fear. He was known as a very religious man who had great reverence for the gods.
But you never know what the gods are going to do one day till the next. You don't know what they're going to bless, what ship they're going to blow apart. But he still, something in him believed, right?
That's correct.
Well, of course, they all believe in the gods and goddesses. That was the ruling principle of being alive. I find it that's what's so fascinating about the book. That's the conflict.
And I would point out when he does arrive in North Africa, and he arrives in Carthage is just being built there, and he goes to Carthage and is still very much afraid. And he sees on the walls, it's such a famous scene of a temple that is being built there, the whole story of Troy. Queen Dido has been building it, and she has heard all these stories. And so this temple has even him as a character on the wall. And he looks at it and says, I had no idea of that we are, everyone knows about us. And I understand that the tears of humanity will guide us to a safe harbor.
Well, I love that. And say it one more time.
Yes, and that's the voice of Virgil, this compassionate, and it's almost an untranslatable phrase. It's in Latin, it's sunt lacrimae rerum. There are tears, lacrimae, for things, for affairs. It's a magical phrase. It's almost untranslatable in English, but that is close as I could get it.
Well, you got very close. And the thing that about the book is that he is so vulnerable. We can really identify with someone who's struggling. It's the hero, you know, will he make it? Will the hero get to that next place? Everything is against him. All the things come to stop him, but he overcomes one thing after another. And there's a love story, too. I mean,
yes.
Dido.
Yes.
Say something. He would rather have stayed with her than gone on his journey.
He dallied in Carthage for too long, as a matter of fact, and she didn't want to let him go. His mother, the goddess of love, had enlisted Cupid and cast a spell around her heart so that only Venus could control her. And Juno, who was the patron saint of Carthage, a patron goddess of, could not influence her because she wanted to protect her son. And then Jupiter got really angry when he dawdled and stayed there, and she didn't want to let him go. She staged this kind of in a cavern, a sort of a marriage that wasn't a real marriage. And then Jupiter sends Mercury to descend on Carthage and finds Aeneas and yells at him, scolds him. Your wife, he says, and, you know, planning a tower for your wife, you know? What about your own son and the kingdom that is foretold for you? And frightens Aeneas to death again, and who immediately changes course. And
what happens to Dido?
Dido, just a dramatic, utterly operatic, finally, secretly, kills herself,
yes.
Builds an altar and burns herself. And there's this utterly, and of course, it's Carthage, which was the greatest enemy of Rome. They almost broke Rome. And they were the greatest enemy and Hannibal was a Carthaginian who occupied and could, at one point, could actually have destroyed Rome if he had been brave enough. And so this curse she issues against Aeneas and the Roman race in that chapter is just, wow, over the top.
You know, this made you come alive more than you knew you could, right?
Yes. Because it always has.
Well, even reading it, I say as a page turner, and love, grief, betrayal, anger, everything's here that modern literature takes from it. And so let's hear another piece of it.
You want to hear another
selection? I'd love to.
Selection?
And set us up with where it is in the book. There are how many sections in the book?
There are 12 books. There are 12 books. The first six are, the first one is of the storm. You start in the middle of things. The second book is his telling of the fall of Troy, which is one of the most fascinating. It keeps building and building. And when you think nothing else, other things occur. I mean, it is one of the most magnificent books. I have a book too, The Fall of Troy, as he tries to save it through the, that there is. And so the little passage I wanted to read, the other thing Virgil does so well is he has a messianic flair. Like no other ancient poet, I believe Virgil must have read the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew literature, and some of that messianic prophecy. Virgil does it in some of his even earlier poetry, and then here does it, and this is Jupiter talking. And so...
Was he married to Juno?
Yes.
Okay.
He is married to Juno, and Venus comes to him, to Jupiter, and yells at him because he's allowed this storm to occur. The fleet, half the fleet, is missing, and Venus is a favorite of Jupiter's, and he calms her down, and then he begins to say, "I will tell you a little more," because she says, "You have betrayed me. I sat there and watched as Troy was destroyed, and you said there would be a greater kingdom. Well, this isn't a greater kingdom." And so, and then he talks about the history, and Romulus would one day arise, that his son Ascanius would have a kingdom, and then later...
There are so many names.
I know. And Romulus and Remus, who founded Rome. And he says this, "Then Ilia, a Trojan princess priestess, will conceive by Mars and give birth to twins who will be nursed by a she-wolf and clothed in tawny animal skins. One of them, Romulus, will become the great ruler of this people. He will construct the great walls of Mars around seven hills on the Tiber, and his name will forever be the name of his people, the Romans. On them I place no limit on the reach of their dominion or on the years of their governance. Their rule shall be without end. Even fierce Juno, who in her wrath harries them on land and sea, even she will come to cherish the exalted destiny of those who wear the Roman toga as the sovereigns of the world. My decree is unchangeable. And as the sacred seasons slip by, there will come a day when all the cities of Greece, yes, Achilles' homeland at Pythia, Agamemnon's famed Mycenae, they will all bow low before the children of Troy. From the princely stock of Ascanius, your son, and his Julian family, there will be born a Trojan Caesar who will extend the boundaries of empire to the very oceans, and his fame shall stretch to the stars of heaven." He's talking about Octavian, and I want to just skip a little bit and said, and he talks about how his empire is larger than anyone's ever has been. And he says, and he will, and his name will be invoked in the prayers of his people. And then the harshness of the ages will grow mild, and all war shall cease. The Italian gods of the hearth, silver-haired Truth and Vesta, shall mete out justice, and deified Romulus will be reconciled with his brother Remus. The grim iron gates of the temple of war shall be shut, and its locked gates shall confine but one occupant, godless war fever. huddled atop piles of abandoned, pitiless weapons, with hands bound behind his back, he will still emit those chilling cries to battle. But only the bronze links of chain that hold him fast shall be roused by his blood-curdling summons.
Did Virgil write in a trance?
It seems that. He's
just channeling divine words. The brain cannot originate those words. What a pleasure to hear and to read. Mm. There's more prophecy here than in the Odyssey. There's more. What is that about, that the fortune-telling is so prevalent with the Romans?
The fortune-telling in the when you think about it, what Aeneas's task wasn't for him. It was about his people in the distant future, a very dim prospect. Mm. Part of his wavering probably is, Virgil doesn't say it that way, but when you think about it, yeah, he was going to found a city, but it was only later that the Romans would rule the world, much, much later. And so it's a vague destiny when you think about it.
Very interesting. And that is part of the complexity of his psychology. It
yes.
isn't just a caricature of a hero. It's the not knowingness and the indecision, and yet the compulsion to follow his duty, as you say, to be dutiful.
And with that Roman sense of, I'm not bending, this is my duty, and even if it's ruthlessness, if it's cruelty, if I have to do it, I must do it.
More than the Greeks?
Yes, it's there's something very Roman, and they did a lot of brutal things to get control of the world, but not as much. It wasn't just conquest. They were also so smart.
Yeah.
They allied with people and gave them rights, usually reinstalled, even in the leaders they had that they could trust. Rather, and not enslave them or any of that, with one always proviso. That's how they got all of Italy. We draft the soldiers. They are ours. And otherwise, you can do this, 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 this. Otherwise, you're free.
One thing we will do.
But that was the thing. They always had far more soldiers than any enemy. Once they began this conquest, and that was the key. And when Hannibal occupied Italy, and he was there for, I think, 13 years, that alliance held, that Italian identity that they had created held, and they were loyal to Rome mostly.
That's fascinating.
So it was very interesting. They were very, very interesting.
How did you prepare for the writing? You had read several translations.
I had read several, but I wanted to come to it fresh. I wanted mine to be all new. I wasn't looking over my shoulder to see who. If I did, I was stuck, and then would take a look and say, "What did so and so do with this? I can't figure this out because the Latin is so difficult." But no, otherwise, I wanted to catch this poetry. And this poet who just gives me the chills.
And so you managed to keep going because of you loved it. And you loved, do you like to do the difficult?
Yes.
Oh, there we go. You love the difficult. I knew there was a secret to you.
When I was a lawyer, all my partners wanted easy cases. And I said, not me. I want tough cases.
That is so like you. And how did it... practicing the law prepare you to that kind of writing? Did it help you as you went along that you had that experience?
Well, I wrote my whole life expository prose for the law, but it kept me sharp, and so this was, and this was again a labor of love. And it had much more poetry than the law ever had.
I think.
And it was very attractive to me. And so I just couldn't put it down.
You know, a lot of lawyers are good poets because the love of language. And it is not, they are not two separate things, really. So you had that going for you. And we know that love kept you going. And what did you find the most difficult? The translation of particular words?
It was always guessing as best I could what was going on for the poet. What was he doing with this phrase, with this sentence? Why had he put it there? And I made it my task to try to figure that out if I could, because it gave me a better chance. And only then would I write the words.
Is there not a little Aeneas in you with your sense of duty?
Yes. I think Aeneas is the first modern hero. There is no one in the Greeks that is quite as hesitant,
complex,
as unsure and complicated.
And human.
Yes, as Aeneas. Virgil. Virgil creates that hero.
Well, now that you've climbed Mount Olympus, what are you going to do next?
I don't have a clue. I do music, and I may I arrange music, and I mostly songs that I love. You know, sometimes for movies.
Yeah, but you can't stay away from Latin. Who's available? Well, I know you're going to do it. I know you can't stay away from Latin. It is your love.
It is my love, but the hill I wanted to climb, I have climbed.
How many men can say that?
This was an obsession. I knew I'd never get rich on it, but I wanted a readable version Virgil was the top of the heap for in the ancient world as poets. Once he wrote this Aeneid, for 1,500 years, Virgil was the scholar's choice as a great poet. Dante recognized him. Dante, he becomes Dante's guide.
Yes.
And he does book 6, his version of the underworld. Dante then based his entire work on what Virgil created in book 6 when Aeneas descends to the underworld,
which is utterly
fascinating.
It is a real gripper, that section. The underworld is looking for his father.
Yes.
Yes. And finally, before we hear a last reading, what was little Richard Colarisi like as a child? Must have been a bookworm.
Yes. I loved science fiction, but I also read other things. I believe as a kid, I read a kid's version of the Aeneid in the library that I found. I was not doing well in school, in elementary school, and so a teacher said, you need to get him a library card and take him to the library. And I could walk to this huge library we had in my town. And so I started picking things. And I just read so many things. I remember reading and marveling at the Aeneid because it was like it doesn't quit. There's always, around the next corner, something that's just utterly magnificent.
You were hooked.
I didn't remember that till I was older, but I realized, this was the first time I ever read the Aeneid entirely, my book. When I translated it, it was when it was a book. And suddenly I sat down with it and said, this is what I wanted to do.
But you see, that was prophecy in the library.
Yes, it was.
It was. And may we have a final reading? This is on Amazon, and wouldn't Virgil be surprised to be on Amazon.
Okay, I've lost it.
There it is.
Do you see it?
Yep, a nice marker, very organized.
Okay, this is the whole last 6 books are basically war in Latium, as they rebel. And Turnus is the great villain, sort of the Achilles in the Italian version, pursuing the Trojans. And so he does a surprise attack Aeneas goes away to try to get help because he doesn't have enough people. All the tribes of Italy are now arrayed against him. And the river Tiber appears to him and tells him, if you go upstream a little bit in the Tiber, there are seven hills up there, and there is a king who will help you there, a Greek king who the Latins hate. And so he sends him there for aid, and he stops the river, the Tiber does, and he goes north, and he leaves them. And while he's gone, Juno sends a messenger to Turnus, and he goes and attacks his men in their makeshift fort. And so he arrives there. They see him coming, and Aeneas has said, you may not go in the field in open battle. There's too many of them. You've got to stay behind the walls, which they think is a cowardice thing, but they obey him. And so Turnus shows up there and starts screaming at them, and they won't come out. And he goes berserk. He's so mad. And he says, what can I do? Oh, there's their ships. We're going to burn their ships. And so he rushes over there and does that. And so this scene, it's such an interesting combination of poetry and warfare, as Virgil is always so original. And so tell me, O muses, this is Virgil talking, what divine god or goddess saved the Trojan fleet? Who kept the ships from blazing into a great conflagration? Belief in the ancient lay is old, but its fame is ever fresh and new. And so he then recites that when Aeneas was left Troy and built his fleet, he used the lumber from the god Jupiter's mother. She's called Cybele, or the Magna Martyr, used a forest that she allowed him to use to build his fleet. And then as Aeneas was getting ready to sail away with the fleet, she went to her son and said, I want you to promise me that not one of those ships will be harmed. That's my wood. And Jupiter says, I can't guarantee that. Even the gods don't have that kind of protection. I can't give you that. And so she intervenes as Turnus is getting ready to burn the fleet, and he promises her that any ship that makes it to Latium, he will take care of. And with a nod, all of heaven shakes and the fate is set. So as he heads towards the fleet, she appears, Cybele. Let me see. So let me get to
it's
that.
It's her wood.
It's her wood. And with the ships now safe, this was the moment when the decree sealed by Jupiter's nod can be fulfilled. For the instant the ever watchful Cybele catches sight of Turnus approaching her sacred ships with torches, she springs into action. A strange light suddenly floods the eyes of the mortals there, and a swift cloud sweeps in from the east, bearing the matronly goddess, attended by her cymbal-clanging entourage. A dire voice of warning booms across the heavens, filling the ears of the Trojans and Italians alike. Men of Troy, stay where you are. Raise no weapon to defend the ships. Turnus shall soon set all the world's ocean afire before I will allow him to burn these, my sacred trees. Mm-hmm. And you, my dear ships, go on your way. Yes, my holy children of sanctified wood, you are now set free. You are ships no more, but bright goddesses of the sea. Mm. Such is the command of thine ancient mother. The ships promptly break the moorings, holding their sterns to the bank. Their beaks plunge into the river like a line of dolphins, and when they resurface, miraculously, each ship is an immortal maiden frolicking in the sea.
the voice of Richard Colarisi reading from his new translation of the Aeneid, available on Amazon. Virgil couldn't have imagined being available on Amazon. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.